So it looks like you're back, and I hope the cookies are tasting well. I don't know how it is with your lives, but I think we probably have shared issues in our life's experience. I think one of the issues many of us sense keenly is just the sheer magnitude, of the things that I have to attend to, and the sheer mass of the impingements on all my senses, on my little bit of attentiveness. I wish I could speak to you in Danish, and I trust that you will either interrupt me to find a translation if something is not comprehensible, or that you will rely on some of our friends who can probably help you with this. So this is not quite as ideal as I would like to have it to reach out to you, but I trust that you are either willing to interrupt or bring up questions if things are not comprehensible, or that you will find help nearby. I know many of you are probably very, very proficient in English, but sometimes these things get in the way. So please feel free to either interrupt or ask somebody who ask a question or ask your neighbor. Don't hesitate. It is important to me to be understood. Yeah? So, issues of our time. You've seen I've given this evening's talk the title of the Four Resolves, Four Great Resolves, and I think one of the challenges we have is to reorient towards what is sane, towards what is urgent, and towards what is systemically healthy. Yeah. Often enough, because our attention is strongly conditioned, doesn't gravitate to necessarily these three points. It gravitates generally to what is most urgent, it gravitates to what is most loud, and it gravitates to things that we either like or we fear. Yeah. Most of our attention is habitual attention. Most of our attention is what psychologists call involuntary attention. And involuntary attention runs to things that it is habituated. Yeah, habituated with. So, tonight is a small suggestion that we find in Buddhist teaching how to orient our precious resource of attention. You remember, attention is finite. Yeah, there isn't an awful lot of it. It's limited, and it actually can't do so many things at one and the same moment. Yeah, the span is actually remarkably short. Yeah. And the amount of different items we can hold in our attention at one time is very, very limited. On a good day, it's maybe seven. On a bad day, it's maybe four. Yeah. So these are things that we can, in one moment, hold as discrete objects of our attention. Yeah. So that means if you look at the table, and there's four pieces of cutlery on there, or maybe seven pieces of cutlery on there. And you are at the same time capable of identifying what this is and how many there are. Okay, that's the type of attention we're speaking of. It's easy with one, and it's also easy with 50 because nobody can see 50 discrete entities on the table. Yeah? We just know it's a heap. But the specificity of our attention is very, very precious. And so this poor attention is unfortunately already limited from the beginning, but then it is even more limited by being preoccupied. It is preoccupied with filtering out things I don't want. It is preoccupied with getting things I do want. And it is preoccupied with processing inner stuff. Yeah. The skill we have of being in a different place with the mind than the body is a double-edged sword. Yeah. On one level, this helps us being in one place and planning about what we do on the next place or in the next place. And this can be useful. But it also can be a problem because it means we are never exactly at the place we are. Yeah. There are different ways of referring to this. The polite way to refer to this is called multitasking. The somewhat less polite way referring to this is called dissociation and disembodiment. Yeah, those would be more clinical terms. I say that as a footnote. Just Buddhist teaching, Buddhist psychology particularly, is highly aware that our attention is a precious resource and it's a limited resource, yeah, right from the beginning. And that we must make the best possible use of it. That's the bad news. The good news is it can be trained. The good news is it can be strengthened. The good news is it can be oriented. We are not condemned to pay attention to things that don't make us happy, that are not useful to us, and that leave us parched and tired afterwards. The good news is we have choices. The good news is we can train attention and we can train making good choices. Yeah. That's one of the real messages of Asian teachings. Both the yogic and the Buddhist tradition are really clear about this. That's one of their powerful messages, that these are skills, and skills are things you can train. So I want to tell you a story tonight. The story goes back a long time, and it's about a young person who, in the days of the Buddha, has heard of the Buddha. This young person has a name. He is called Pukkusati. There's some conflicting messages about this person. We have different sources of texts that tell us his story. So one text, the root text, tells us an account where this is a young aspirant, we would call him, who seeks the Buddha. And he lives in a potter shed. In fact, he has visited a place somewhere in a then bigger town that meant about 10,000 people lived there, called Rajagaha. And he was looking for the man whose teaching he had heard of, but whom he had never met before. Yeah. This man was the Buddha, and our young aspirant was looking for the Buddha and spent the night in the workshop of a potter. It just so happened that the Buddha himself was at that place, was also looking to spend the night, and asked the potter whether he could spend the night in his workshop. And the potter said, yes, that's okay. That's perfectly fine with me. But there's already a guy in that workshop. Yeah. So let me go and ask this guy first whether this is okay. Did you join? The Buddha did not identify himself. So the potter went to ask the young aspirant whether he would be okay that this next this monk would spend the night here. And the young aspirant said, oh, yes, there's plenty of space here. Let him come in. So the two ended up in the same workspace of the potter. Potter was working during the day, and during the night he had his workspace open for visiting spiritual seekers. So the two of them sat there and meditated, one looking for the other, not knowing that the other was sitting in front of him. The other we don't know, because we don't know what Buddha think. Yeah? We don't know what the other thought, but he didn't identify himself. So both of them meditated for a long while. And then the Buddha thought, this young aspirant man looks pretty impressive. I wonder if I inquire. And he inquired from him and he asked him a few things. And he says, what is your name and where are you from? And he said, well, my name is Pukkusati. I come from a distant region in northern India. I have heard about the teacher here and I have been inspired to seek this teacher out. And the Buddha thought to himself, well, wonderful, this young man has covered a lot of distance to come and visit a teacher he has never met, he has only heard of. He's a meditator, he seems inspired. How about if I gave him some teaching? Yeah. And then he asked whether he would be interested to hear some teachings. And the younger one said, oh, yes, I am very interested in some teaching. And at that stage, the Buddha really let rip, yeah, and gave him an absolute stunning disquisition of teaching. And he really went to town on this. He gave him a very profound and very detailed exposition of the teaching on elements. If you are interested in reading Buddhist books, this would be the Buddhist book this is in. It's the number 140 of 151 texts, 152 texts. It's a fairly profound discourse, and one would be surprised to hear that the Buddha gives this to somebody he has never met, somebody who isn't even a monk, and somebody who has not received any prior training. Yeah? So it's quite amazing. The Buddha's, you know, a standard didactic approach would be finding out where the guy is, what he has learned, and see whether you can take it from there. But the Buddha somehow is confident that this young man is capable of handling the big scoop. Yeah. So he gives him the big scoop, and he prefaces this big scoop with a wonderful statement. He says, he speaks of the tides of conceivings. Now, I'm interested that somebody translates that into Danish. The tides of conceivings. Tide, I'm sure you have a very clear idea what a tide is. And conceiving is the way we think. Yeah? Conceiving is the fact that we can not just know something, but we make a story about things. Yeah? How would you say the tides of conceiving? Yeah.
We've got a pretty good idea.
You got a working hypothesis going. Good. Good. So, basically, the Buddha gives this young Pukkusati a teaching and says, look, the way we experience the world is via the senses, sense objects, sense consciousness. And then we are affected by this sense consciousness in a way that we like things, that we don't like things, that we are left confused or bored by things. And on the basis of this experience, we are subject to the tides of conceivings. Yeah? These 18 things, the sense basis, the sense objects, and the sense consciousness conjure up a huge wave under which we experience the story-making mind. And we become impassioned, we become desperate, we become aggrieved, we become bored and angry. We become swept away by the tides of conceiving. Yeah. So this is the starting, this is the overture of his teaching. And then he says, giving a glimpse of where he wants to go, it says, there are four kinds of resolves, four kinds of adhitana. When you resolve these four orientations, then you will not be swept away by the tides of conceivings. And he ends sort of with a first statement and says, look, take this as a mantra. This is a big mantra. If you want to train to have foundations that will not be swept away by the tides of conceivings, you need to train, you need to resolve four things. And he says, what are these four things? So one is this, you should not neglect to cultivate wisdom. Yeah. You need to keep coming back, training your skills in being wise and bringing about understanding. Yeah. The second one is you should persevere to establish truthfulness. In other words, you need to understand things as deeply as possible, even if it's not pleasant, even if you don't like it, even if it's difficult, even if it seems endless. You need to understand things as deeply as you possibly can. The third one is interesting. It says you should cultivate either generosity, giving up, or relinquishment. The word means both. It's an interesting word. It's called chaga, and it means giving things away, but also giving things up. Yeah. There's a double edge in there. The giving things away means I relinquish things. At the same time, some of the things I give away are useful to others, you know. So in a way, some of the what I give up is generous because it is useful to others. So I should not neglect wisdom. I should persevere in establishing truthfulness. I should cultivate relinquishment. And I should continually train to be peaceful. Okay? And he says that like he would say a mantra. Now, this is something you should resolve. Whatever you do in your life, wherever you go, whatever is happening, these four resolves are useful. Now let me look at the word he uses for resolve. This is an interesting term. The Pali word for this is made up of two parts. One part, adi, means foundational. This is a base for something. And the other part has to do with standing. Yeah, the second part of adi, tana, the tana part means standing. So something that is capable of holding itself upright. So we have often this term is translated as resolution, as self-determination, or as resolute determination or something like that. It is something that you resolve in yourself as an attitude. Okay? Remember, this is a useful and very important piece we have when we meditate. We were generally interested in a number of things. If we meditate, a few things come into play. One of the things that comes into play is obviously, have a look at this for a moment. When we meditate, when we practice mindfulness, we can't just do one thing. Yeah. This mindfulness practice basically hinges on three things. It hinges on an attitude. This is the part here I'm interested in. Yeah, this left part. I can't. It's this left part. It's an attitude of care. It's something we, this isn't a technique, it's not a method, it's not situational, okay? It is a basic attitude we bring and we keep affirming. Yeah. So Buddhist teaching has names for this. These resolves, these adhitanas, these four great resolves that help orient the mind are part of this attitudinal piece. Yeah. When we practice mindfulness, the attitude is generally being careful, it's being circumspect, prudent, it's being attentive, it's being wakeful, it's being resonant. There's a few things that are not on this page here, but it's an attitude. Yeah. That attitude cannot be replaced. No technique, no method, no state can replace that. So we need an attitude. Yeah. We need to work on this piece here. Yeah. Am I available? How am I with this? What is my energy levels like? What is my engagement? What is my focus? What is my interest? So these four resolves the Buddha teaches the young Pukkhusati are part of this attitude piece. Yeah? There's obviously other things needed, but maybe another time. But tonight, the attitude piece is important. So our four resolves are part of an attitude. The Buddha then continues giving this young aspirant a huge detailed exposition, which I will spare you, and says, basically, you need to work on your attitude. You need to keep coming back to your attitude. And one of the things that is important for your attitude is that you need to keep strengthening your resolves. You need to keep strengthening certain areas in which you continually bring your energy in that you want to cultivate and develop. Wisdom, truthfulness, generosity, peacefulness. Yeah. And the message he gives him is we get identified. The tides of conceivings have to do with identification. It means I experience something and then I identify with that experience. Yeah. I have a thought. The thought is an angry thought, and I experience this as an angry thought. And then I identify with an angry thought, and then I become an angry person. Yeah. This is a little sort of trick the mind does. Yeah. It has an experience, and because it has an experience, it thinks, ah, because this experience happens to me, it becomes my experience. And then something interesting happens because that experience happens, there must be somebody there to whom this experience happens. And then the image shifts. And then suddenly there is a me that has an experience. Yeah? The experience changes and the me stays behind. Okay? This is a sort of a trick that happens through something Buddhist psychology calls identification. We all have lots of experiences and we don't identify with all of them. We identify with some of them. Which ones hinges a bit on your conditioning, it hinges a bit on your socialization, on your upbringing, it hinges a bit on your temperament. Yeah. But we all do this. We all identify. We all appropriate experiences that are happening to us and we then give them the meaning that they become us. So I have an angry thought, I become an angry person. Which is, you know, sometimes this is true, and sometimes, most of the time, it's not true, because even angry people are not permanently angry. It's really difficult to be permanently angry. It's a very strenuous kind of activity, and you need to do a lot of thinking and a lot of hating before you can be angry a long time, because even anger is impermanent, yeah? You're also not always bored. You're not always in love. You're not always a happy bunny, you know. We all know this. But the fact that we identify with some aspects of our experience makes us very prone to suffering. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. And resolving to disidentify is what the Buddha recommends our first in his first teaching on how to cultivate the resolve of wisdom, how to cultivate the panya adhitana, the training of wisdom. And he says you need to keep disidentifying with your experience. And he gives Pukkhusati a detailed explanation of how the elements work. He goes through six elements and he says, look, each one of them is not you. And the big mantra he gives him sounds like basically this. This is not me. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. So if you forget everything tonight, do not forget these two mantras. The first mantra is one should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve truthfulness. One should cultivate relinquishment and generosity. And one should train in peace. That's the first mantra. The second mantra is this is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. Yeah. I think these are useful mantras. And this is what the Buddha gives the young aspirant Pukkhusati. And Pukkhusati is very inspired. The Buddha then continues to teach him more about how to cultivate truthfulness and how to cultivate relinquishment and how to cultivate tranquility. So the two of them spend basically the whole night discoursing. Yeah? And our Pukkhusati is very, very inspired by all this. And at one stage, he realizes whom he has in front of himself. You know, at one stage, he recognizes that some of the teaching he received is teaching of the very nature that has made him inspired to travel across the country and seek out this teacher. So he becomes very embarrassed and says, look, I know who you are. I have recognized you. You are the teacher I am seeking. And please forgive me for not having recognized you. Please forgive me of having not properly addressed you. And the Buddha is very kind and basically says, you know, what would you like to do? And the aspirant says, well, actually, I would like to become a monk with you. Yeah. And the Buddha says, well, to become a monk, you need requisites. You need, you know, you need robes and you need an alms bowl. Do you have robes and an alms bowl? And Pukkhusati says, no, I haven't. And then he says, basically, they agree that Pukkhusati goes into town to find these requisites. And as he leaves, and is, you know, is resolved to come back, he is killed. He is killed by a cow. He is killed by a wild cow. There's several people being killed by cows in Buddhist texts. And this may not sound a terribly likely cause of death, admittedly. But in if you go to an Indian city with narrow alleys, it is quite conceivable that you can be gored to death by a crazy animal that runs through one of these narrow alleys in which you have no place to go and hide. So anyway, our promising young aspirant, after being totally inspired and after having received an exquisite teaching and being very happy that he has found his teacher, does not actually become a monk. Yeah, he dies on that very day. And the Buddha later testifies that he has had a great realization, that he has been a greatly inspired and a greatly gifted young man who unfortunately came to death before he could become his disciple. So There is a great poignancy. There's something sweet in this encounter. There's something, you know, it's so undidactic. Yeah, the idea of the Buddha meeting a young man who looks for the Buddha in a potter shed. And the two of them meditating and spending the night together and talking about Dhamma, and the young one trying to become a monk, receiving this really pithy teaching on the four orientations, and then leaving in the morning and coming to his death is something very poignant, isn't it? So I would want you to, for a moment, to take stock and see whether you can join me in a deeper reflection on these qualities that the Buddha suggested our friend resolve his mind on. Let's see whether we can see. You should be able to see. I've written them down for you. Let's... Yeah, and for completion's sake, let's add this. Yeah. Now, what is there in it for us? Yeah. What are the resolves that help us when we struggle, when we get confused, when we get overwhelmed, when we are sensing that things are endless and futile and our powers are so small in the face of the challenges that we all face, both, you know, individually and globally? In many ways, things are not looking good. Yeah. I do think that these four resolves, if we translate them into our lives, if we translate them into our psychology, actually have a power. You know, they strengthen an attitude of care in our lives. They strengthen an attitude that helps us weather challenging situations. So I let them stand here for a moment, and I would like to ask Sine to maybe help you guys splitting into groups, so that you have 20 minutes to discuss, maybe in groups of three, whether there is something you recognize, yeah, that resolving attitudinal orientations help us in the moment of challenge. Yeah, I'm happy for you. I'm happy to send you the PDF. So, for those of you who don't have your mobiles to make a snapshot, I will make sure that you get a copy of the PDF with the two statements. Let me rephrase the question. Sitting down in groups of three, spending 20 minutes on a shared inquiry. How can I practice consistently the wisdom function in my life? What are the things I already do, and what are the things I feel I could do to improve that? How can I practice truthfulness in the face of challenge, in the face of difficulty, in the face of complexity? Often that is a huge issue, complexity. Conflicting statements. How can I practice truthfulness in that? Establishing the deepest possible understanding. What are the things I am doing to make this more real? And what could I do more? How do I give up things, and how am I generous with things? That would be the third of the resolves. What am I already doing, and how could I do more? What are my practical steps in training the mind to be more peaceful, and training my relationships to be more peaceful, and training my societies to be more peaceful? What am I already doing, and what could I do more? Okay. Those would be questions. Can I leave this in your hands and we meet again in 25 minutes? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
So.